I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask out of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Baby fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989. Here, swimming with the sperms in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
I'm Felisco. Do we have the Beach Boys playing along with those sperm?
Yeah, I think this movie has a great soundtrack.
It does have a great soundtrack.
Corinne Steichman here, hanging out, talking.
Hi, friends.
Talking. Look who's talking. Look who's talking. It's Corinne.
See, that's right.
If I had any brain cells left, after being up with my son from 1 o'clock last night, I would have gotten that joke on the first try, but I don't. So, Corinne, I'm going to leave this to you to handle this.
But I would also say, Kenny, that you being up with an infant feels appropriate.
Yeah, you can feel Christy Alley's emotions more than we can today.
You know what the irony is? I love this movie deeply. Mm-hmm. And I watched this movie right before I went to bed last night. So I watched this movie from like 9 to 11. And while I'm watching the movie, as listeners know, because I can't stop talking about it, I have two little boys, right? I have a 1.5-year-old and a 3.5-year-old to go along with my 8-year-old children. And all I was thinking during this movie was, God, I miss my kids. Now, I saw them just an hour and a half earlier. But like, it's like, oh, I just want to be with my kids. They're so much fun. The boys are so much fun. I love like messing around with them. And it's a real be careful what you wish for, because then I spent the next 6 hours trying to get this 3-year-old back to sleep, using every trick in the book.
When your child is crying, do you hear the song from Look Who's Talking, the Cry Baby song when he's crying?
No, that's not what crying sounds like. You hear Pantera in your head.
What eventually worked? Was it just like, all right, I'm tired now.
Exhaustion? It's 6 a.m.
Nothing. This has never happened in my entire time. I'm an 8-year-old. I've been going at this for 8 years. He woke up at 1 and he never went back to bed. The way we get to bed with this particular kid, it's different with all kids, is I put on the sleep music from the Headspace app. And it works every time. But for some reason, this wasn't working, and he was just like, I just want to walk, and I just want to stand. I just want to walk, and I just want to stand. and he likes, he has a desk chair in his room, and he likes moving the desk chair around like it's a car. And nothing worked. Finally, at 7 o'clock, my wife woke up, and I handed him over, and it was wild, yeah.
Oof.
So, can I ask a question? Which I feel like we touched on this a little bit in our Baby Geniuses episode on our main feed, which was the last baby movie that we talked about. A bad baby movie, just to be clear, not about like technically bad babies, but just a bad baby movie.
Well, there's no such thing as a bad baby.
Yeah, there's that too. Do you feel like this is a good representation of having a child? Or I'm asking you that since you're the only one on this podcast with a child.
Yes, this is a good representation of having a child.
Okay. Do you think it's one of the best ones? Like, I guess my question is, what do you think is the best representation of having an infant?
This.
Okay.
Of all okay. movies. Of all.
I can't. Yes, because this movie acknowledges how hard it is, how life changing it is. How, you know, I've always said this is my favorite episode because I get to talk about being a parent without feeling shame. I not shame about being a parent, shame about monopolizing the podcast with my parents. I've always said by far the biggest leap is from zero children to one child. Because that is when your life goes from your own to somebody else's. And after that, you know, going from one to two is hard, and two to three is hard, and three to four is hard. But at that point, you know, it's an easier jump every time. The way I, you know, from three to four, I always say we were already at a boil. Like, it really doesn't matter. At that point, I can add four or five kids at this point. I know how to juggle two or three kids at a time. So that's not a hard thing. But so it accurately nails the I had my own life. Now my life belongs to someone else. My life is fundamentally harder in every way now. I have to make decisions at every moment of my day, that first and foremost have to account for the fact that I'm making sure a vulnerable, helpless child stays alive. And then what it does really well is, in a non-cloying, sentimental, stupid way, shows the joy of being a parent and shows how Molly's life is better or more enriched now than it was before, even if the circumstances under which she became a parent are not ideal for her, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking about how, and it's not something I thought of when I was watching the film, but in hindsight, Kirstie Alley does a tremendous job of showing a real unquestionable love for this child. I know that seems like an obvious thing to say, but when I think about how few actors successfully convey that when they're in a situation like this, she is glowing when she's around this kid, and it really goes so far towards making the film as lovable as it is.
I would also argue that John Travolta does the same thing.
I was going to say,
which,
yeah,
maybe sure, is also because he's not the father. It really, like, it gets you. You're like, how can you not love this guy? He's giving the baby a high five. That's cool.
I have so much to say about this movie. both of those things you just said, like, made me want to just, you know, go 60 miles an hour down different sides of this, different roads of this highway. But just to kind of hit what you said first, Phil, yeah, I think the brilliance of this movie is two things. One, you watch the movie with this is all like at least our second. I'm guessing, Corinne, you've seen this dozens of times.
Millions.
I've seen this millions of times.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I don't know why I watched it as a kid. I didn't understand it, but I loved it.
Me too. Right? I certainly didn't know what they were swimming in the beginning or what was happening. But, and Phil, I know you've seen this before. And when you watch it a little more critical eye, I think what comes out is just how good the adults are and just how strong the scenes without Mikey are. Like, the scenes between Kirstie Alley and Olympia Dukakis are really charming and really interesting. The chemistry between the two leads is smoldering. It's insane. But the So that's one thing you pick up. The other thing that I would say is the magic trick of this movie, and the part of the reason I think that Kirstie Alley's character so believably is in love with this child the way a mother is in love with her child is because the child is able to give you his point of view. In most movies and television shows, infants are just inanimate objects. They're just dilemmas. In this movie, this child is able to give the love back and say, you got to love her about the mom, or he really enjoys being around his mom and he really appreciates his mom. And you hear him voice that. So the love goes two ways, which you never actually see or feel in a movie. It's what you want to believe an infant is saying and thinking, but you never really – it's not even a matter of never really knowing for sure, because I think we all look at infants and I think we think they really don't have agency. They really don't have internal monologues. They really don't have any real psychology to speak of. And I do think that in general hurts the ability for a parent to sell their love for a kid. Just by way of example, we did Ghostbusters 2. And I think Sigourney Weaver does a pretty great job of showing her love for her child. It's not the same. You know, it does not have the same heft that this does.
And I would also say that the more modern version of this is like the precocious Stewie Family Guy child who's like smarter than a baby should be. And it's funny in a way that's like, oh, he's just a baby, but look at his big mind and like Boss Baby and all that stuff. That's kind of like, so to have a kid who's actually speaking like a kid probably would, I mean, baby, whatever, like with the infant, like wonder and all that kind of thing, and have it still be funny and feel really like pointed and still be funny in a way that's very true to a baby. I think that's just so.
Well, lost. I think you're also both circling something that really cannot be sort of underlined enough, which is this movie shouldn't work. This movie should not work. It's called Look Who's Talking, guys. And it's about a baby whose thoughts we can hear. Like, this is just, it's like a laundry list of things not to do, of like hacky, shitty things you should, like, you know what I mean? And I say that as a testament to how good this movie is, that it works. I mean, Heckerling has been pretty open about the fact that she went to every studio in town and they were all like, we're not into this, because it was sexual and sort of weird and kind of pushing boundaries and also leaning into some kind of tropey things of like, of comedy that I guess what I'm getting at is I could understand somebody reading this script and being like, I don't know if you can pull this off.
So I was going to say, you know, every studio turned it down. Good for them. Like, I get that this was a wild runaway hit, right?
Yes.
One of the biggest hits we're ever going to do on the show in terms of return on investment.
Yep.
But this on paper is the kind of shit that drive you nuts as another writer to be like, they sold a movie about a talking baby.
What's so crazy to me is that I know this isn't the way that it was conceived, but it conceived. It feels like it's the kind of movie that you have this sweet little script about a single mom trying to find a dad for her kid. And then the studio comes in and is like, what if the baby talks? Let's make the talking baby. And then the writer's like, okay, I guess I'll make that work. But the fact that she came to them and was like, this is my idea, it's broad. And they were like, no, I just feel like it's, the reverse is true now.
Which is why I also said good for them, Grid. Yes. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's like, the kind of stupid idea that you would think like a bad executive would foist upon a good writer.
Yeah.
Yep. I would also say too, it should be said that the sort of the inkling of this idea is her and her husband. It's Amy Heckerling and her husband had a baby, and her husband was like doing what I assume every fucking parent does, which is like pretending that the baby's talking to the wife, like doing bits, like doing jokes or whatever, right? Like,
I mean, I do it with my cats. I'm assuming the children.
But, you know, it's all you got.
Exactly. But it's all just a long way of saying, like, everyone does this, but not everyone is able to comment on the other side with this movie, I guess is what I'm getting at. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's crazy.
It also shouldn't work because it is two movies. Like, it's this talking baby, which is the movie I watched as a kid. And yeah. then there's the, like, love story, which is the main movie, which I watched yesterday. And the switch between those two things should be like, whoa, what are we doing? You know, this kid's talking.
Well, it's also a movie about being a single mom on top of everything else. Like, I mean, which ultimately I think is really kind of what the movie's about, which is this person who gets thrown into these circumstances that she's mm-hmm. not particularly prepared for. She's hoping that the father of this child is going to come through, which he obviously never does. And, you know, it's obviously about finding love in the last place you're looking for it and that kind of stuff. But, like, it's really about Molly finding her independence and figuring out how to become this person.
What's actually interesting – sorry, go ahead, Kenny.
No, go ahead. Very quickly, it's a meditation of modern feminism, but go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it's interesting because it's like – it's about this woman who has made this mistake of having this affair with this guy who's like a – you know, well-to-do deadbeat and just
played by George Segal of all people. Can we talk about the fact that this guy's like a player in this movie?
He's not an attractive man. I don't understand it.
George Segal. All right. So this is my George Segal entree as well, of course. And I always thought he was a piece of shit because of this movie. Now my George Segal appreciation, you know, has spanned quite a bit. George Segal is considered like a very good looking man for a period of time, right?
Was in that the period in the 80s?
That period
was
in the
70s.
60s and 70s, right? Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf through like California Split? He was a hot guy.
But he was a hot guy like Elliot Gould was a hot guy, right? Kind of hot guy.
All right.
And Elliot Gould was good looking. It's a funny, he was the hot guy in the movie where they were together in California Split, and Elliot Gould played the goof. But but the thing about a guy like George Segal and Elliot Gould is they have like legacy hotness. Right. Yep. So even for people our age who came to them when they were like old and, you know, a little frumpy and a little like hangy and whatever. I know my mom, for instance, would always be like, oh, that George Segal.
Same with my mom, by the way. Like, George, I remember. Well, there was that time when like your Albert Brooks and your Elliot Gould and basically just kind of nebbishy Jewish guys that kind of had this moment. And I feel like my mother felt very similarly with George Segal as well. I get why that George Segal could convincingly be in this movie. But the George Segal we got, you got to scratch your head a little bit and be like, this is the guy?
I mean, unfortunately, it makes it look like he's just a very wealthy guy. Though she's never like, oh, I'm into this for the money. But like, he just seems like a rich New York guy who's like, look at my Mexican tuffed couch or whatever that I'm getting from wherever.
Yeah, I think this might be a little bit like if today a love interest was played by, say, Rob Lowe. Where like Rob Lowe now is a 50-year-old man who you and I, or the three of us know, was once like the most beautiful man on earth, but now is a little worn down by life. I think, and I think a younger person might be like, this is the person Selena Gomez is dating? I mean, oh, so.
That's interesting.
Selena Gomez is dating Rob Lowe.
He's speaking in
fiction. Hypothetically, if there is a movie where –
Molly's
33 in this movie.
I think she fudges her age. She's like, I'm 33.
You think she's supposed to be older?
I think she might be
35.
She's
like 35.
I think she says 33 because she's embarrassed.
Oh, 35. Yeah. She's amazing. She's amazing. So, all right. So that's what a movie.
are we done?
No. That's kind of the one lane. I want to get back to the other thing Corinne had said earlier, I think this movie has grown in esteem for me, and has gone from a movie I always kind of loved and I've probably seen it 100 times to a movie that like actually means something more to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't really pick it up until last night or maybe the last time I watched it with my kids. John Travolta in this movie is the modern archetype for what a modern father should be. He is a unabashedly masculine person. Not that you need to be, But just that, you know, that's a way to kind of bring down that barrier of masculinity not necessarily jiving with fatherhood. He's an unabashedly masculine guy who is willing to be subordinate to the woman in his life and unabashedly love this child. But do it in a way that's completely his own. So he puts on his music. He plays with him in his way. He roughhouses with him in a safe way. He gives him high fives. They watch games together. It's all these things that I didn't realize that I've been doing with my kids for their whole life. And I think this is the germ of it. And I think that the thing that I love about it so much is I'd never seen it before. Fatherhood before this movie was always in the Mr. Mom vein. We're like, how does a dad relate to their kids?
Or three men and a baby, or something like that.
And a baby, like we wouldn't even know what a diaper if we saw him. I mean, this movie, he's bragging about how many diapers he changes, right? So it's like this vein where men and parenthood shouldn't even meet.
Well, even look at the way he is with his grandfather as well, right? I mean, his whole storyline is focused on him being supportive to his grandfather, trying to find way. I mean, he is a stand-up guy, even if he's always looking for a free way to get something.
Right, but it's an unconventional stand-up guyness. It's like the switch from what's his name, rich older man dude, to Albert, John. George. Yeah, that's your conventional leading man. And that's who she thinks he should be with. And it's learning like what makes a good, it's like her journey is learning what makes a good person. And she realizes
also,
that
I want to just piggyback on that for a very quick second and just say, there's also a little bit of a class distinction going on there too, right? Which is Albert comes from money. John Travolta doesn't. When she has that nightmare vision of what their future could be like, which is insane, where like she's got like three kids and they're living in squalor and he sounds like it's like something from The Honeymooners or whatever, like or some crazy, you know, shitty sitcom. Married with Children. Like she's got this kind of there's an unfortunate sort of class distinction as well in terms of like what a man is supposed to be, how supportive he's supposed to be, and what he's supposed to bring to the table. Which I think
it is unfortunate in society. In the movie, it is actually the dilemma for her, right? Mm-hmm. It is actually the choice she has to make. And I think, Corinne, you're making this point, but I think that there's really something cool about Amy Heckerling, who obviously she's a genius, but clearly she's also an earner, right? Like clearly she's also, you know, she doesn't need anybody else to put food on her table.
Correct.
Saying that this is another way to do it, and it probably is preferable for a lot of people. And I think Molly realizing that going for the quote-unquote money, and that's all you get, versus the father, and she's very clear that she wants the person best for Mikey. Mm-hmm. But she does make the argument at some point that, you know, Albert has other children, and he's good to his other children, and he has a nice house, and he has all this stuff. To recognize that she is taking care of the things that Albert could also potentially take care of, and if she's not doing it right now, she should be able to in the future. What she really needs is a partner in raising this child. I think is Amy Heckerling basically saying, like, let's reimagine modern marriage, and that's why I think that or modern co-parenting, and I think that's why I think it's a meditation of modern feminism. Mm-hmm. That's not so. You know, an unmarried woman. That's not so about it. And a lot of the times, I think that these kind of movies are the way that you kind of Trojan horse those ideas into.
I also, you know, I totally agree, and I would also say too that you know, she hides the pregnancy the conception of the pregnancy from her mother for a little bit of time, but then once it becomes sort of common knowledge, there's no judgment. There's none of that, like, you know, you got pregnant out of wedlock or any of that sort of bullshit, which is another sort of to your point, Kenny. Like Amy Heckerling is being very sort of like this is the world now. Like this is just how it is, and I mean. Amy Heckerling, and we need to sort of unpack her a little bit because she's one of those careers that really shouldn't have played out the way that it has over the last, I would say, 15 or 20 years. I mean, she deserved to have many more tremendous movies. And I think that, you know, she had a feature in, I think it was in 2012, she had that Vampire Academy thing, which, you know, I imagine she thought was going to be, you know, bigger than it was. It obviously wasn't. She's done a bunch of TV. It's not like she's not working. But when you look at the first half of her career, you look at, like, she has three stone cold masterpieces, I would say. Yeah. I mean, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Clueless, and this movie are basically perfect comedies.
All turned into television shows, too.
Would you agree, Kenny?
Yeah. What's kind of weird is I'm crazy about Look Who's Talking. It's definitely the third on the list for me. Clueless is probably, like, you know, top five comedy for me of all time. And Fast Times, to me, it has issues now, but it's a really important movie to me. You know, that really was very fundamental in, like, how I looked at what you could do with movies.
Well, it was a defining teen comedy at the time, and still is, in terms of, like, breaking boundaries of what you could or couldn't do in a teen comedy.
Yeah, and that stuff is culturally important. It's culturally important to tell the story of Jennifer Jason's Lee's abortion, for instance.
Absolutely.
But for me, it doesn't matter that much because, you know, when I started writing, that barrier was broken 25 years ago. So that's great. But structurally, that movie is wild. Structurally, that movie breaks every rule that you think you know about teen comedies and coming of age stories and all that. And I love that. But one last thing about Amy Heckerling is, like, those movies are fairly low concept, Clueless, mm-hmm. and Fast Times. Mm-hmm. This movie is one of those things where it's like, if you're good, you're good. Phil, like, you and I every once in a while will see a announcement on Deadline or Hollywood Reporter or whatever that's just like, this sounds fucking crazy. But if anyone can pull this off, it's this particular filmmaker, and I am down to check it out. Right? Like, the one for me that will always be in my head forever and ever is Social Network. Social Network seemed like the stupidest idea. Right? Like a modern, like 3 years ago telling of this guy that, like, my parents barely heard about and who seemed totally uninteresting, based on a book by the guy who wrote Bringing Down the House. So it's basically like, you know, airport books for frat boys. Like, the whole thing sounded so lame to me, but it was Fincher and it was Sorkin and I had to see what was up. So, like, when you're good, you're good. And she's just so good.
Well, go ahead, Corinne.
Oh, no. Just what's so interesting about this movie is, like, it comes at the tail end of the 80s when there's, like, the baby movies and the, like, single working mom movies. And she kind of takes all the things that those movies were doing and she throws them out the window. And she's like, let's not have a single mom where it's like, oh, is it my job or my baby? I don't know. I can't do both. It's not, oh, can I have it all? It's just kind of like, she's sacrificing her own happiness and looking for a father. That's the only goal she has. There's no money problems. There's no question of, like, oh, but I just need to get back out there because I'm single and I don't know what to do. Like, it's like she's learning that you have to have, like, it's okay to find somebody that you connect with and have an emotional vulnerability with, as opposed to these other movies like Baby Boom, which I've only seen once and I saw it recently, so... Maybe not.
But I would argue that Diane Keaton can basically make any movie good. But
the question there is, like, can she have a high powered lifestyle and a child?
Can she have it all?
And the answer was no. She had to move to Connecticut. Like, she had to buy a house and, like, start selling home goods or, like, groceries or something very feminine, which I know.
But I think it's interesting because I think you're bringing up, because I believe Nancy Myers wrote Baby Boom, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I do think those are two very different and interesting lanes, because I think these are both female filmmakers who found ways to build, you know, very strong careers for themselves, and also give agency to the women in their movies. I mean, they basically have female protagonists in all their films, understandably so. I mean, Heckerling, just to kind of very briefly walk through, like, she does Fast Times. It's her first movie in 82. She has a movie called Johnny Dangerously with Michael Keaton in 84. She does, I think, Kenny's least favorite National Lampoon movie, A European Vacation, in 85.
Still good, though. Like, I had no qualms.
Yeah, no, just...
Not sure.
Then she does Look Who's Talking in 89. Look Who's Talking 2 comes out in 90, like, the next year. They're just like, holy shit, how do we get this out as quickly as is humanly possible?
That movie is a different
And then
story.
She does Clueless in 95, which is obviously a big hit. She doesn't do a film for 5 years. And she has a movie called Loser, which I've never seen. The Jason Biggs Mina Sorvino movie.
It was that was supposed to be a thing, right? That was Biggs off of American Pie. That was Amanda Subari off American Pie and American Beauty. Like,
yeah,
Amy Heckling off Clueless. It just didn't work. But that really is like
it should have been a thing. Yeah,
if she had a blank check that bounced, that was the blank check that bounced. I mean, Clueless was a big check, blank check that cashed.
But, you know, listen, she does. They do a Clueless TV show. They do a Fast Times TV show. She does the pilot of both of those shows. And then she has a bunch of TV. Gossip Girl, Carrie Diaries, Suburgatory, Rake. I mean, she's working, and as she should. But it is, to your point, Corinne, like, interesting that of the two, of the Nancy Meyers or the Amy Heckerling, Nancy Meyers finds arguably more success, or at least a more sort of a longer tail. I, you know, perhaps there is something about the Amy Heckerling kind of anti-establishmentarianism that she has sort of in her movies that perhaps, I don't know, maybe that has something to do with it.
I want to take this thing for a second that we're doing.
Sure.
Because in a couple ways. One is one doesn't exist without the other. You have to have your baby booms and your Mr. Moms before you get this movie. Yeah. So I think that, you know, that's one part. Secondly, that the thing that I think I love about the conception of this movie is this movie, if you were to tell someone what it's about, somebody who's never seen it, an alien, you would say this movie is about a baby whose thoughts you can hear. And Correct. You wouldn't say this movie is about a single mother trying to figure out the best path forward for her and her baby, which is what the movie's actually about,
yep.
right? If you were to pitch the Talking Baby movie or the Talking Baby show to anybody, I think that most people would imagine nuclear family, mother, father, cis, hetero people with their baby – who talks about how crazy it is to be a baby. And that's what a boring filmmaker would do. But Amy Heckerling did this in such a way where all the things we're talking about, what the movie is about, what the movie is undoubtedly about, it's not about a talking baby. Like, it's just not.
No.
It's not about a talking baby as much as, like, Jurassic Park is about dinosaurs coming back. Like, that's not what this movie is about. The movie is always about the adult protagonist characters. But because she decided to frame it the way she framed it, it Trojan horses this idea of normalizing different kinds of families. Yep. And I think that is so fucking cool because as a child, I saw this movie in the theaters, right? And I distinctly remember the sperm and not knowing what it was. Mm-hmm. I distinctly remember some girl at school telling me that it's sperm and not knowing what that word meant. I and then telling other people it's sperm and not knowing what it meant. but I as a child, that just was another way to have a family because of movies like this, mm-hmm. right? That didn't feel like, oh, this is new and weird, which is what I think the baby boomers and Mr. Moms do. Now, again, it was new and weird. I believe those, I mean, I think Mr. Mom is 82 and baby boom is like 83, something like that. So right. I do think that like studio comedies kind of had to kick down the door and be like, all right, we're gonna soft pedal these different kinds of, you know, 1980s relationships. But,
you know, it's I love funny, that. When you were like, it's not a talking baby movie, and it's not a talking baby movie, despite the fact that, you know,
it
people
is.
Might think it is or that it was marketed that way.
By the way, is a talking baby movie. But
correct. And I want to make a brief comparison because this just goes to show – A, how hard this movie must have been to make, but B, how good a director Amy Heckerling is, that the performances of the babies and the children in this movie absolutely fucking work. The jokes don't work without the performances of the kids actually speaking to each other. Right now, a lot of this is obviously Bruce Willis is probably kind of saw a cut of this movie and like, whatever. Like, I'm sure there was riffing and I'm sure there was ad-libbing in terms of to play off of the kids' reactions. But still, the idea of directing this fucking movie and trying to get these kids to give you performances like fucking infants is just, I can't even process.
Well, what I would say imagine. To that is like, I should preface this by saying one of my biggest pet peeves are children who act like adults and adults who act like children. I don't like either. So yeah.
Yep.
But so to, she just made these kids be kids. They're just like, do some, like make them like laugh, be silly, shake around, cry your head off, sit on the couch and watch TV, try and get the remote. Like it wasn't like they were like, but look at him inquisitively and like you're going to think about like Newton's physics or something. Like it was just like, be a kid and we'll throw the commentary in later. But here's the basics of what we want to do. So I think that's why it comes off so real. It's, they're not, they're just kids. Like he's just a baby and he's just got baby thoughts.
No, I absolutely agree with you. It has a very sort of off the cuff. It feels very lived in for a movie that has a lot of, let's be real, surreal kind of moments in it and goes for like some weird shit mixed into all of this. To Kenny's point, there's a very genuine, heartfelt movie here with really great performances from the two leads. And it just all feels very genuine. Like it all feels, and it shouldn't. This movie makes no sense. This movie should not work. I watched all, you know, hour and 45 minutes of it yesterday, just thinking like, what? Like, and it also proves your point too, Kenny, that you made earlier, which is that like, it's these weirdo swings that can connect with an audience in a way that nothing fucking else can.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where you're just like, you know, let's see. And hand, you got to hand it to TriStar for taking a swing on this thing. They gave her $7 million and said like, sure.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Go to Vancouver, you know? And make it look like New York.
It's crazy. Let me give a brief synopsis and just a little bit of context. The romantic ups and downs of accountant Molly Jensen, played by Kirstie Alley, are viewed cynically by a most unusual bystander, her talking newborn, Mikey, voiced by Bruce Willis. She becomes pregnant through an affair with a married man, Albert, played by George Segal, and then counts on the friendship of taxi driver James, played by John Travolta, once she discovers Albert is a lying cad. Although Mikey likes James and James cares for both baby and Molly, she isn't sure she can settle down with a blue-collared boyfriend. Lucas Talking opened on October 13th, 1989 in first place with $12 million. It would go on to make $300 million on a $7 million budget. That is essentially $650 million today on...
How much?
$650 million today.
That's like, wow. Avengers money, right?
Yes.
What did Avengers make?
Well, Avengers made $2 billion, but yes.
Okay.
It's well, you're talking worldwide, though. Like, yeah. I mean, the number you just gave was domestic, right?
Or that I believe worldwide? That's worldwide. I believe that's worldwide.
That is like Marvel. That is not quite Marvel, but like, because a lot of those make a billion. But we're, I mean, $650
million. Dollars.
For a rom-com, like.
I would say the only movie that comes close to this is probably My Big Fat Greek Wedding in terms of investment to return. Right, of like, here's less than $10 million, you know.
People don't talk about this like that, though, right? Because My Big Fat Greek Wedding didn't make anywhere near this much money. It was like 150, 180, something like that.
Keep talking.
I don't know this movie as this movie that was so successful in 1989. People kind of write it off now, and they're like, oh, that movie is that even good anymore? That's not that great.
Yes. So. Just for context, my Big Fat Greek Wedding came out in 2002, $5 million budget, $368 million worldwide. So, but again, to your point, that's pretty good, but it's half of what Look Who's Talking made in now money.
And on top of that, to your point, Phil, people talk about My Big Fat Greek Wedding and never will stop talking about My Big Fat Greek Wedding because My Big Fat Greek Wedding seems replicable. In a way that Blair Witch, for instance, doesn't, right?
You know what's interesting is I rewatched My Big Fat Greek Wedding maybe a year ago for some reason. Mm-hmm. Doesn't hold up for me. This movie held up. Like it because the story is ever,
would disagree with you.
I found it to be quite broad. It's a very broad comedy. And I know, listen, talking babies, this is a broad comedy, but there's a real story with real characters at the heart of this, which is, and it's an evergreen story that doesn't feel dated or old.
This is one of those things where, I mean, it should also be said, Luke is talking 56% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics in 89, 47% from audiences, which already, both those numbers make no sense.
Insane.
47?
Yeah. I was reading some. Yeah. People did not like this movie.
Is this movie considered to be, I never have met someone who has seen this movie who doesn't have one of two opinions of it. One is that it's a classic, which is the correct opinion. Or the other is the opinion Corinne just espoused, which is like, I haven't seen it in a while. I remember liking it. I'm guessing it's not good anymore. But people actively not like this movie? That's absurd.
Yeah, like I read like the New York Times and the Rolling Stones reviews from the time, and they were all like, this is slapstick. Travolta looks fat. What is this clown doing back on the scene?
I agree that was the general consensus. That being said, Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars and said, as silly entertainment, Look Who's Talking is full of good feeling, and director Amy Heckerling finds a light touch for her lightweight material. Travolta demonstrates 12 years after Saturday Night Fever that he is a warm and winning actor when he's not shoehorned into the wrong roles. Ally finds the kind of role she must have been looking for, a role that lets us see the person who is always there beneath all those hours of TV images. Fuck you for shitting on TV, Roger Ebert, but that's neither here nor there.
A different time.
And Cheers nonetheless. Yeah, like a perfect television nonetheless. but I think that, Kenny, to your point, I fully fucking agree with you. And those Rotten Tomatoes scores kind of baffled me. The critics, I mean, okay, we could make an argument about hoity-toity critics maybe being shitty about it. But this movie made so much fucking money. Audiences clearly loved this thing. It makes no sense.
This movie is like, to me, this movie is like Home Alone. One of these evergreen, perfect little, which I watched Home Alone 3 nights ago because, you know, I watch it every 4 weeks. Perfect.
Not with your children. That's just you going to bed.
Just you by yourself?
I run the 5 Home Alones every once a week.
That's fair.
And, you know, if I, kids, no kids, just however I get there. But. Just a perfect little 1 hour and 45 minute gem. Just works so well, and just obviously connected with audiences. It's that elusive four quadrant movie. It's that you can bring your kids. There are jokes for the adults. There are jokes for the kids. And the jokes will be over the kids' heads. It doesn't matter. So, you know, God.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think that this is one of those movies that, just to be clear, I haven't watched this film recently, right? Like, you guys have watched this film probably more times than I have in the ensuing 20-some-odd years or so.
Yes, I had watched it actually only 9 months before I watched
it. Okay, and Kenny, you've watched it many times over the years, correct?
I've watched it with my older kids at least twice. This was a movie that we really kind of felt.
So I had a little more distance from it. So for me, this is a movie that truly I haven't watched since I was a kid. So probably since close to 89-ish, around that. Loved it as a kid, watched it a ton as a kid. When I watched it yesterday, though, it's a much stranger film. The in utero stuff is kind of gross, if I'm being honest. It didn't work as well for me as a kid. I don't think I knew what I was watching, but like the sperm stuff was kind of gross. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just being silly, but these are things that at the time felt broader and funnier. And in hindsight, I watched yesterday and was like, this is weird.
But it's kind of incredible that they did that. Like, that's like, can you imagine going to a studio being like, no, we want to see inside the uterus at the moment of conception and we want to give voices to it. Are you in? And they're like, yeah, that sounds great. And everybody
we're
going
to puppets, we're going to make an in utero baby.
And I think what's so fascinating is like, we've all confessed to this now, is that we watched it and we loved it and we didn't know what was going on.
Didn't have any idea.
With puppets, anything animated, I feel like, sure. And also the Beach Boys for me was my first big band that I loved. So the Beach Boys plus puppets, I was like, I don't get it, but I like it. Puppets.
I think, I think it's iconic. I think so much of this movie comes from those opening shots of the sperm. I wouldn't have shown the baby in utero. I agree with you there. I don't think you get anything out of that.
Yeah, I guess they were just trying to establish that he talks or that this is going to be a thing. Or it's like, oh, we got Bruce Willis. We got to have him say something in there.
I must confess, I've been very busy. And I almost didn't watch this again for this, which I've never done for a podcast. But I've seen this movie so many times that I felt like I could do it either way. I'm happy I did. Because I didn't remember that there's like a good 10 minutes before the baby's born, which seems not the best to me. Yeah. Which is not how I would have done it. I would have done sperm. I would have done sperm, baby. The way baby. It's done in real life.
They tried to have it both ways. That's why they had him talking in there. So like, we got to get the baby. It's called Look Who's Talking.
The real Mel Gaze kind of way is sex. The baby shows up. Right? Don't even think about the pregnancy. Because, like, to me, it doesn't even happen.
But I think it's also warming up the audience to his thoughts.
Right.
So you know that when the kid comes out, you're going to get thoughts. I guess.
I don't need it.
I don't need either of it.
One of my favorite joke things or joke structures, I guess, that they do in the first 10 minutes when Molly and old guy, what's his name again? George Steinway?
George Siegel.
Siegel, gotcha. I think that's the guy who invented pianos. Maybe not.
Yeah.
When they're talking and we only hear about his wife through their descriptions of her, Beth.
Yeah.
And it kind of keeps mounting until you find out she's bulimic. And she's like, when I found out I was pregnant with Mikey, I, you know, wrote a will. And then when she found out she was pregnant with the girls, she had a reading of their past lives. And it's just, I love that joke. It's never not funny. It's the Marison Fraser. Yeah. And it starts, like, I think that's the first scene where they're talking about this woman who you'll never meet and how crazy she is.
You're also underlining something that I think needs to be said. Despite the fact that Kirstie Alley has spun off this planet and no longer exists with us anymore, she had a moment in the 80s and 90s where she could fucking nail a joke like nobody else. Mm-hmm. Like, she finds this emotional way of making a joke funny. You know what I mean? Like, it's baked in emotion. And it's really fucking funny. And that's incredibly hard to do. And this film is brimming with it.
Yeah.
Hot take. There should have been multiple Oscar nominations for this movie. especially Phil, we've looked at the Oscar nominations for Best Actress this year. Like two of the people we've never heard of.
Never heard of.
One of the movies, the third is a movie we've never heard of. So I think she should have been nominated. I think he should have been nominated. I think Olivia Dukakis should have been nominated. I think Abe Vigoda should have been nominated. I think that the screenplay should have been nominated.
The one I'm most surprised about is that Amy Heckerling didn't get a screenplay nomination.
Movies like this have gotten nominated or got nominations throughout the 80s. I mean, this Olivia Dukakis does this right after Moonstruck. She won the Academy Award. Cher won the Academy Award. What? Moonstruck, a movie I love. So this is not slight on Moonstruck. Why is Moonstruck better than this?
It's very similar. I had the feeling of it being very similar because it's about a woman who's like becoming
a man.
Like learning about being emotional about your choice in a person is not a bad thing. I think that's kind of Moonstruck. She's like, I fell in love with this guy.
They're very similar, actually. Like and her choosing Nicolas Cage. And there's very similar kind of. Choice in the middle of the movie, except like she doesn't have the added, you know, encumbrance of I have a new baby I have to take care of, and we're dealing with this heightened tone, and we have to be funny in a way that appeals to families.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I again love Moonstruck. I think Kirstie Alley's doing everything Cher does in that movie and more.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that I agree with you. I mean, in the sense that I think that both these films, Moonstruck and this film, sort of elevate the genre that they're in, you know what I mean? Certainly go above and beyond what you would expect from films of that ilk. I think everyone in this film is great. I really do. I want to just talk briefly for a second about some of the casting that didn't happen. For the voice of Mikey, you had Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Steve Martin, and John Candy were all sort of considered. I could see Steve Martin, John Candy for sure. Maybe
John
a Bill
Candy
Murray
would have been great.
But ultimately, what Bruce Willis brings to it is a little bit of edge. And that edge is what makes it really sing. Because you're just like, Bruce Willis is a guy that you're never really sure you're supposed to like. You know what I mean? He's always playing this.
Right? You do.
A little, but you love him. But there's like a little bit of a prickliness or something going on there that you're just like, but can I trust this guy completely? No. And him being the voice of Mikey is genius.
It's a sports thing, right? It's like there are a lot of players on other teams who you're like, that guy's an asshole. If they were on your team, they'd be your asshole, right? And to me, that's who Willis always plays. He's yes. your asshole. You know, and I love that about him, right? He is my asshole. He's an asshole. He's an asshole for the righteous. He's an asshole for the downtrodden. He's also, you know, and I think this speaks to something kind of deep inside of him, deep inside of The Rock, deep inside of Jason Statham. These are my 8-year-old son's favorite actors, right? Yeah, there's just something about these guys, and Van Damme too, by the way, something about these guys who have the ability to play tough guys, but also convincingly play like loving dads mm-hmm. or like heroes of, you know, like heroes of the world or things like that. That really is like very, very movie starish to me. I think that most people on that list would have ruined the movie, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think they would have been able to I think it would have been, obviously, I think it would have been a weaker film for it. And I would also argue too, you know, you've got Bruce Willis in 89 is a big star, right? Like he's come off of Die Hard, which is 88, if I'm not mistaken.
Is he doing Moonlighting at this point too?
Yeah, but he's
a big deal.
But he's not in the stratosphere of Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Steve Martin, and John Candy. Those guys are like icons of the 80s. And I think that that helps you too, which is I think the film would become too much of a look. Chevy Chase is the voice of this baby. I think it would have cast a shadow.
You know, the other guy who could have done this? John Travolta. They could have swapped roles and the movie would have worked.
I
the two of these, those guys, that and then Pulp Fiction were incredibly like Mikey kills. What was his name? I can't believe I can't remember his name.
Oh, Vincent Vega?
No, not Vincent Vega. His name in this movie. Jimmy.
Oh,
James.
Jimmy.
Well, James. Mikey kills James in Pulp Fiction. Like those two are forever kind of yeah. married in my mind. Maybe from this movie and then from Pulp Fiction, but they both are two. They're almost like the vanilla and chocolate version of the same candy bar.
I see that. Yeah. Corinne just jumped up. There's a cat and it's making noises. Speaking of casting, for the James role, the other people that were in talks for it, Michael Keaton, Mel Gibson, Jeff Goldblum, Griffin Dunn, Steve Guttenberg.
Say it again?
Yeah. Michael Keaton, Mel Gibson, Jeff Goldblum, Griffin Dunn, Steve Guttenberg.
They're all bad choices.
They're all bad choices. They're all wrong.
I appreciate the Gutenberg love. Always in favor of Gutenberg love.
You know, he was great in Three Men and a Baby.
He was, but I don't know that he gives off the, Michael Keaton's too big. Mel Gibson's an action star and he would have been wrong. Jeff Goldblum's the wrong energy and Griffin Dunn's just not a big enough star. So like it ultimately, you said it earlier, Kenny, which is that Travolta, who has actually said about this role that it is the role that is the closest to him as an actual person, which I think speaks volumes as well. Like he just locked into deeply. This.
Yeah. It's also who I want to believe John Travolta is.
Sure.
It's why John Travolta through all the Scientology stuff has never kind of gone on my, do not publicly like this man list, sure, you know, sure. Like Tom Cruise was on a do not publicly like this man list for a while. I think he's off of that now. Christy Alley's on that list. Definitely on a do not publicly like this person. I don't think Travolta ever really got there. And I think that his run from this particular movie, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. really, really softened his profile
100%.
With, you know, America at Large. And then his run after Pulp Fiction, particularly Get Shorty, which there's something about that performance as Chili Parma that's just like legendarily endearing. That I don't think any. Yeah, Go.
No, I think that that's you singling out Kid Shorty is very astute, because that's the performance where there's a hint of danger in the sense that he's a hitman, or, you know what I mean, that he's capable of killing a person. And yet it's still John, like that might be the quintessential John Travolta performance. Like, that might be him showing all of his skills, the full range of what he's capable of nailing a joke, of also feeling foreboding if he needs to, coming from the wrong side of the tracks, like all that stuff, and also being like the classiest motherfucker in the room. He's great.
I quite liked the John Travolta is one of the two or three biggest movie stars in the world era. I like his movie star persona a lot.
It's funny. I feel like this movie for him was like Julia Roberts' My Best Friend's Wedding moment, where it was like, she'd kind of gone away. Nobody really cared about her. She totally came back. Yeah. Everybody's like, she did Mary Riley. Is this going to be good? And then it was like, oh, it's great. Look at how great she is. Let's give her a moment. So then that, you know, it feels like that. Well,
he reminded us why we love him. You know what I mean? Like, he had this moment where he was like, listen, I'm a good guy. I mean, it's the Vinnie Barbarino sort of thing, right? It's like, it's this guy that sort of, you know, he's cool and you want to hang out with him, but like, he might not be the sharpest tool in the shed. There's that scene when he's talking to Mikey where he like opens up, pours out his heart to this kid, and he kind of seems like a little bit of adult, like he, and in the best possible way, in the very John Travolta sort of way of being just
is.
Okay.
he definitely is a little bit of adult. That's kind of what it is. I mean, he's a guy, yeah. He puts his psychic energy into like figuring out how to make free long distance phone calls. Like, he does not have a lot going on except he's a really good guy.
Yeah,
like he's a deeply good guy. And if he wasn't a good guy, the premise of this movie would fall apart, because if you remember, he takes Molly to the hospital. He recognizes very quickly she has nobody with her. He decides to go and be a helping guy. 99 out of 100 men, that is disqualifying, right? I'd say 999 out of 1,000 men, that move is disqualifying. But I also believe that you have that people have the ability to kind of see through to the innate goodness in someone. His next move is to send mail to her apartment to fraudulently living in that apartment.
Yeah.
He is living in that apartment, and she catches him stealing her mail. All right, as a make good. This guy says, I will make it up to you with free babysitting.
Only three times, though. He's like, I'm just going to do it three times, and then we're square.
All I've ever done is follow you into the hospital, into the fucking OR to deliver your baby after meeting you, and fraudulently claim to be living in your apartment, then try to steal your mail. Yep. I can make it up to you by babysitting your baby. And she says, sure. And she doesn't say sure because she's desperate. She has her mom. She has Twin Kaplan, who I'm confident is Amy Heckerling's like twin on screen.
I totally agree.
She's so great. But
she does it because she can clearly tell that he's a good guy, which he is.
Yep. I totally agree with you. I think that it's, again, you just sort of outlined several sort of like conceits. Like, this movie has buy-ins to a certain degree. Yeah. But the buy-ins, and this, again, you know, to harken back to Hunter Covington's Chill Factor episode, the tone is everything. This movie locks itself in early and says, if you're on for the ride, you're not going to give a shit about some of these weird things where it's like, mail and babysitting and like all these sort of things, because you're going to care about these two people, and you know you're going to go along on this kind of insane ride. I mean, of like old age home stuff and things that you're just sort of like, okay, yeah. I mean, this movie's got its heart in the right place, and I'll go anywhere I got to go with Molly and James and Mikey.
The thing is, I think that makes him really human, though, like the stuff about the mail fraud. Like, it makes him not the perfect guy. And, like, because we see him as being so great, you got to give the audience, or Molly at least, a reason to be like, I don't know if this is the guy I want raising my kid. He's a scammer. So it's like, and I kind of feel like it's such a, it's such a nuanced, small, like weird thing that she really had to sit down and think about, like what could make him a good guy and a bad guy at the same time. And it's actually brilliant because it's also not too broad. It's not like, oh, he just says stuff in a cab. This is my New York guy, I guess. Like, hey, broad, like, what are we doing tonight? We're going to the club.
I mean, he does ask if she's a lesbo.
Well, that is a tricky moment. That is not great. Not great. I think it makes him the perfect, like, not perfect guy, but still, like, his heart is in the right place. And it makes him a rich character. And I just don't think you get that in a lot of rom-coms. Sometimes you just get like, oh, he's a nice guy. You should get with this guy.
And the other thing I kind of love about this movie is it is 100% a rom-com. It is also not about.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The rom, if that makes sense. This is not about two people chasing each other throughout the movie. This is about two people understanding that they've been almost drafted to be partners in something. And that supersedes anything else that happens throughout the movie. And because of their, you know, proximity, their love for Mikey, and kind of their and this is the most important thing about raising kids, their shared understanding of how they want this kid to be brought up, which is kind of remarkable to me. They fall more and more in love. And there are little moments throughout it. Like I have so many favorite moments in this movie, but a moment that really, really works for me and hits me in the exact right place, and this is why Kirstie Alley should have been nominated for an Oscar, is when she does the Town Without Pity dance, right? When she's about to feed Mikey the pudding, and she's alone in the apartment, and she's dancing with the pudding, and she's kind of doing this like silly, sexy thing, and you do, when you're just alone with your infant, you're doing things that like, you're basically dancing in a room alone. Nothing counts. Nothing happens. She does that wildly sexy hip move.
It's insane.
I do not dance like that when I'm alone.
The fridge. I mean, that she had that move in her is kind of hard to believe. That wildly sexy move reminds the audience in a way that like she doesn't just clean up well like she does for the day. It's like this is a really, really attractive, sexy woman.
Who's an accountant?
An accountant, which is sexy too.
Yeah, it makes it sexy.
Love women who do math. he walks in. She's immediately mortified in the way anyone would be mortified if they caught you doing something like this. He does his James thing because he is so confident and so cool, and also he has complete hand on her in this. He's the one coming into the embarrassing situation.
And he's John Travolta, and he's got the moves. And
he can dance, and he's cool. And by the end of that, he has her dancing with her again at like 75% of what she was doing when she was alone. But she's still into it. Like, that to me is yes anding. And like, people don't really even understand that that's what a relationship's about. Like, it's just yes anding. It's like, all right, I will go with you on this. I will go with you on this. Like, I will like not make you feel too stupid about this. We can have fun with this moment together. And they do. And to me, that's what I'm like. This goes way beyond any kind of, you know, partnership for the sake of a child. Like, these two people need to be together.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also, the other scene that did that for me as well was the flying scene. Where he takes her flying. So, I mean, I have to wonder, John Travolta is a pilot. So I don't know if that actually played into this in some way.
Do you remember what happens in the sequel, which is not great? Well, so they get married and I think he becomes like a commercial airline pilot.
He becomes like a private jet pilot.
Yeah. And then it becomes more about like, she wants him to start making more money, basically.
She wants him to work for an airline and he's like taking around rich people for the time being.
Yeah. That might be the one with the talking dogs. I don't remember.
That's Look Who's Talking Now.
Which doesn't even have Bruce Willis. Like, now the kids can talk for themselves. But I mean,
we should talk about the logic of kid talking.
Yeah.
A second, because I buy Mikey just talking because, like, he's got – or an internal monologue. When Mikey starts conversing with the other babies
– I don't love.
It gave me pause.
I don't love. I think their conversation is adorable, and I love the way the girl says, that's the daddy, the daddy, the mommy, it's the mommy.
Yeah.
No, that's the one with the sandbox when he's just kind of –
No, it's the daddy. It's, you know, the
daddy. It's the man type. Hang out with the mommy. You know, the mommy.
Yeah.
Mommy.
That was the only time the conversation turned to being like.
Well, because it gets to this place, which I agree, where from a script, like from a plot perspective, we're now supposed to believe that Mikey has agency and wants to actually affect the relationship. It's like the idea of, I want James to be my dad.
Right. You have to establish that somehow.
That doesn't bother me. That's important to the movie. What bothers me is, I think, what Corinne is saying, which is they have baby ESP.
Yeah, they're telepathic. And I think you can achieve that. Because like what you get out of that scene is like him being like, oh, I want a daddy. I'm going to ask James to be my daddy. You can get that out of a million different – like I came up with four different scenarios where they could have gotten the same information out. So it feels like maybe that was the studio note of like, let's have all the babies talk. And she was like, okay, I'll do it in one scene. And then you'll see it's weird and we won't do it again.
They do it in the sequel though, remember?
It's all in the sequel.
Oh yeah, the kids are talking to each other.
It's Roseanne Barr and Bruce Willis.
Damon Wayans is in it talking to the other babies.
Yeah, it's weird that it's Joan Rivers at the end of the movie, but it's Roseanne Barr in the sequel.
Wait, the kid? During the credits? I missed it.
Yeah.
Turned off.
Yeah, at the very end, he talks with his newborn sister, and it's Joan Rivers, who's uncredited. This movie also does, like, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but like it has some surreal kind of like pop to strange things. Happens earlier where Molly has some nightmares of it being old, and finally Albert, you know, saying that he wants to be with her, or hanging from a clock like Buster Keaton, basically. I mean, it's really cool and weird.
Was that Buster Keaton? I thought it was like 39 Steps. Is that both?
Maybe. I'm pretty sure.
Maybe they both do it.
But yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of like, and also the moment when like she wants the epidural and the nurse won't give it to her and she turns to a fucking demon and says, fuck my breathing.
It sounds like The Exorcist.
Like that kind of stuff really kind of, totally, it just goes to show that you need those breathers and you need those things in order to buy into, you know, talking babies and, you know, baby thoughts and all this sort of shit. If you don't have that stuff, I just don't know that you'd be able to keep people on the ride in the same way. I mean, it's just sort of like, I the grandfather stuff's great. Ava Goda looks literally 150 in this movie and still lives for, what you said, 27 more years?
27 more years. Every time Ava Goda – first of all, Ava Goda, and you just watched The Godfather, right, Phil?
I did.
Ava Goda looked 100 in The Godfather. The Godfather
– easily.
The Godfather was 1972. And he looked 100. This movie is a mere 17 years after that, and he looks 110. he is the oldest looking man I've ever seen, and the oldest thing I've ever seen anybody does was when he takes the giant clump of mashed potatoes and misses his mouth.
Oh, and so heartbreaking! And then the baby's like, "I can do this."
Yeah, but this is why Ava Goda deserves an Oscar nomination. Mm-hmm. When he softens and smiles when Mikey actually feeds him, my heart melts. It's like, oh, this kid is bringing the best out of everybody. And then Ava Goda would be on, like, I think like Conan would use him here and there, or Kim. I think it was Conan would use him here and there. This guy only died 4 years ago.
Oh my God. He's like, it's like Angela Lansbury. I mean, she was old in Sister Act, and that was 92 or 91.
Angela Lansbury was old in Manchurian Candidate. That was 16 years ago.
Maggie Smith. I made a mistake. But yeah, her too.
You're right about Maggie Smith, which was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But Angela Lansbury is still alive.
Yeah, and is still, yeah.
Was playing the mother to an adult son in the Manchurian Candidate, which I believe is 62. Mm-hmm. I mean,
she's been old her whole life. But I think that, I mean, not to get too into it, but I think that's like the terrible thing about the industry is like you're either 20 or you're 60 and you have to pick a lane. And I think Angela Lansbury is like, this lane's going to get me to my old age. Let's start it now.
Yeah. Not anymore, I don't think. I think that I hope and I think that there are now
there's
roles
more gray areas, right?
Between 30 and 50. I think that that's happening, but I think that there are actually fewer roles for women in their 20s now. Am I crazy?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
All right. I mean, I think that, I mean, basically, you know, at this point in the movie, you know, James takes Mikey to meet his grandfather and she thinks that the kid's been kidnapped and, you know, there's all these kind of things that happen. The one thing I wanted to, there's one bit that I didn't love, which is the Splinter bit. Do you remember this?
Yeah. Really? Why not?
She does not like Splinter.
Oh, Molly, I know what you're saying.
Splinter, and then the mother is outside the door in the hallway, and she's hearing all of this obvious sexual innuendo, but like it's so big, and I don't know how it got in there, and the mother's supposed to think that like they're fucking, I guess.
And then James walks out.
And zips up his fly, and you're just like, this felt beneath the movie.
Well, that there's a strain of kind of really broad jokes that just didn't work for me in general. Like when Mikey's in the play box telepathically speaking to his friends, and he's like, did you guys hear about the one about three babies screwing a light bulb? I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. And then he's like, yeah, what's a light bulb? And that's the punchline because he's a baby and he doesn't know what a light bulb is, but he knows the joke structure of like that timeless joke of the light bulb. Doesn't know what a light bulb is. I'm like, that doesn't work for me. And it's like, there's a vein of cheesy broad jokes in here that feel like.
There is one of the great jokes of all time though. And I hesitate to say it, but the joke about lunch is the funniest boob joke that's ever been made.
Oh, so that fell into the broad crowd.
You don't think falls into, that's not a great joke to me.
Why isn't that funny to you?
For me, as a woman, or is
well,
as a comedic writer.
More as a, I don't care.
I think it's just, I just think it's,
however it hits you.
So the joke is big boobed lady at reception desk.
Yes.
John Travolta being like, jugs. And then him telling Mikey to look at the boobs and being like, do you see, like, oh, you get.
You must see what he says, you're thinking what I'm thinking. And then it says
like lunch. Because he wants to, yes. I guess, breastfeed.
Yes.
I just don't. It's just, it's a very.
You're,
I don't like that the woman's boobs are the joke. I don't like that that's the joke.
They're not, that's not the joke.
Well, it's,
that's the setup. The joke is that the joke, it's actually a really kind of lovely set. It's a really lovely understated joke about what a baby sees. This is how I really feel about the joke.
Okay.
It upends your typical like male objectification of boobs and reorients you to understand that these exist for a reason. And when seen through the eyes of a baby, that of course a baby doesn't think, I want to have sex with this woman. The baby thinks lunch.
See,
it is a fantastic.
I think it condones the behavior that will evolve into Mikey when he becomes John Travolta's age of thinking that boobs are sweet. And it's like, this is how it starts. You just want to eat from them, but then you want to like have sex with her. Like that's the progression of a male desire.
That's a different joke. You spent 9 months getting out and the rest of your life getting back in. That's a different, less good joke. Also not
a bad joke. Better.
That's not a bad joke, but this joke undercuts decades and decades of objectification and grounds the viewer.
I think it augments it. It cements it as a reason.
I'll just say this. I feel as though you're both making valid points. I appreciate that Kenny is seeing the intellectualism of it and the good-heartedness of it. Personally speaking, I just, no matter how you cut it, it's just not a joke that I particularly, it's just, to me, it's just not a joke that I love. But I can understand how, like, there is something, I mean, this is a, you know, a female writer-director. She's coming at it from a different perspective. I don't know. It also, it's a trailer joke is the other thing too, where it just like, it felt very kind of like.
I don't like fart jokes or poop jokes.
See, I'll take a poop joke any day of the week.
That's great.
It's weird. It's weird. I don't know why I like them.
But my point is, I can appreciate a good fart joke or a poop joke when I see one. And the good fart joke and the good poop joke generally is not about farts or poops. It's about reactions to farts or poops, or it's about situations that farts or poops put you in. So all I'm saying is boobs exist, and you could make you could have fun with jokes in and around the boob area.
Yeah.
But I agree that a joke about a woman having big boobs is a bad joke. A joke about boobs being actually sources of nourishment for a child is a good joke.
Can I just say that? I will say this: the poop joke is actually a perfect segue to Molly going on a date with this guy who talks about his colon.
Don't love that. Don't love the poop. Oh, that's actually funny to me. But I don't love when she. I hate when she puts the poop on the desk. When she puts the dirty diaper on the desk, I turtle into my shirt.
Because it's gross, or because he doesn't.
Because it's gross. Okay. Poop on a surface.
It's also a very visceral shot of the poop. Like, we got to see it, which I'm not keen on. I like it when you're like, oh, I guess it was there.
Yeah,
I agree that.
I did like when he was like, did he just take a dump? She's like, no, he's doing his taxes. Like. That's great. That's a great poop joke. Of course it is.
That's a poop joke?
No, he's thinking really hard.
Yeah, he's thinking really hard. Yeah, that was it.
That's a good poop joke.
That's a great poop joke. Nobody gets hurt.
But the thing that I think Hollywood will never understand is that poop, seeing that poop put on that desk a million times more scarring to me as a child than all the sperm in the world going through all the fallopian tubes to all of the eggs. I will, like...
Yeah, because you didn't understand what one of them was.
And even if I did...
You didn't know what poop was, you'd be like, that's funny too.
It wouldn't bother me. No, I wouldn't. Never. No. I know. It's like the Chris Rock thing. Like, when you're 12, you only know poop. So, like, every joke he made when he first, like, started as a... It might have been Eddie Murphy. Every joke they made when, I think it's Eddie Murphy, when he started was about poop. It was like, you know when you poop and the water hits you, when you poop and it hits you, when you're sitting in the toilet. Like, that was his big joke.
That's a great joke. Yeah.
I do think that, so Molly goes on a date with,
it's just like, oh, yeah, even 12-year-olds have that issue.
So Molly goes on a date with this guy that her mom sets her up with. James basically screws the guy over by telling him that she's a quote-unquote feminist and that he shouldn't pay for anything. He should let her do everything.
Their whole date is exceptional.
It's pretty great.
What's so great about that, just quickly, is like, you don't know if he's doing that to sabotage the date or because he wants to go to his date, which is supposed to start at 9.
Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting.
And I was like, I couldn't tell which one he was doing.
Keep going. I think the date's great because it's so uncomfortable.
I never thought it might have been the latter, but that really is that's really astute.
It's always stewing this or putting the thing in her brain of like, this guy might not be great, and that's just another thing that he does. You can misinterpret both ways.
And furthermore, this guy might not be in it for Molly, which is like. Which I love. Mm-hmm. Like that always felt like the moment where I'm like, oh, he's showing his cards a little bit, right? Like, he's trying to sabotage this date because he wants her. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. I think plays a lot.
He's dressed in a suit and tie.
Yeah, he's ready to go.
Great.
But all that being said, the date that Molly goes on is great. The guy won't pay for the check. The guy won't pay for the movie. He won't open any doors for her. And then he jumps her bones and tries to like kiss her at the end of the date. And he's like,
he doesn't think he did anything wrong. I mean, I'm not defending him, but he doesn't think the date went poorly. He thinks he nailed it, right? Like, he thinks he thinks like, I did all the things I was supposed to do. I didn't hold any doors. I didn't pay for any checks. Like, I am her dream man. And most guys don't do what I do. Most guys try to hold doors for her. So she must want to kiss me now.
Mm-hmm. But then she says no. And then he says, come on, it's early. Like a predator.
Oh, he's a piece of shit. Don't get me wrong. But I understand, I understand why he thought that this was going to end the way he thought it was going to end. He's garbage. But he's a very good actor, that guy.
Yeah, he was great. I also intercut into this date is one of my favorite moments in the film. Travolta dancing with Mikey to Walking on Sunshine.
So good.
Mm-hmm. It's just great. It's obviously, you know, Travolta, great dancer, obviously known for his dancing. So there was going to be a dancing scene in this, I guess, one way or another. But this one comes back to what you were saying, Kenny, earlier, about how much he loves this kid and how much he wants to have fun with this kid and that he wants Mikey to be having a good time. And, like, the song is fucking great. And Travolta's a great dancer. Yeah. Like, you can't go wrong.
My favorite part also is when the date shows up and they're waiting. Like, he's waiting with John Travolta. He's giving him all that bad advice. And Mikey takes the remote. He's like, it's the Bear Show. And it's a commercial for the toilet paper. Such a great actor. I love that commercial. And then the guy's like, no, let's watch the game. He's like, but the Bear Show is on. Like,
that's the Bear Show.
So funny, because it's what a kid would think. It's what we all thought. And John Travolta would let him watch that Bear Show if he was sitting on the couch with us.
It's the Bear Show is great. I also love that he keeps flicking the channel back. And then at one point he just looks at him and goes, what a dick. There's something about, about Bruce fucking Willis's delivery where you're just like, ugh, it's perfect.
Yeah. No, it's very dry.
Back to that Walking on Sunshine scene. That is magic. That is magic. Nobody else can pull that off. John Travolta and a baby, like John Travolta looking as happy as he's ever looked in his life, really makes me believe he's actually a good dad in real life. You're right. The song is perfect. The dancing is amazing. Bruce Willis is little like, they never do that for me. I love that. I love the way he throws the puppets at Mikey and just has his face there. And that's actually a good reveal, like as opposed to a bad reveal. Yeah. Like, he's more fun than the puppets. That was the scene where I'm like, God, I just want to go hang out with my kids right now. I just want to do the same shit that he's doing. Yeah. Like, having kids, if you are not lame, is the most fun. It's because, like, I think so many people, like, and that's why the question at the beginning, Phil, like, is this a good like kind of depiction
parenting
of
movie.
Like, parenthood? Yeah. I think most movies, like, they're handbags. Kids are basically like handbags. You know, they go where the other people go, and they're just kind of, or their burdens, or their exhaustion, or their reasons why people can't get to sleep. And they are all these things in this movie, but God, like, you never actually see the fun of it. You see, like, oh, we take them to the zoo and we enjoy something together, but you never actually see the fun of it. And even in this movie, something I fucking love about this movie, when Molly takes Mikey to the zoo, it's not just standing in front of the tiger cage. It's the two of them with a goat on their lap also. It's interacting. It's tactile. It's sensitive. It really is. There's something that Amy Heckerling deeply understands about why parenting and why having kids is not just like furling your seed forward, which is what I think so many professionals think it is. You know, it's not just seeding. It's not just seeding the planet for the future.
Totally.
Of kids. So
seeding the planet for the future.
But I think that's what, like, so many, particularly men, seem to think that's what childhood is. Like, look at a movie that's nothing about this, but it is also about, like, family and legacy and parenting, Succession, which is the Finest Show. But Succession deeply understands that Logan only had these children to have four shots at having a great legacy. That's it.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about anything other than that. Donald Trump only had these children to potentially have a legacy. That's why he's pushing Ivanka so hard to run for president, because only how it reflects on him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a real, like, because, you know, the vast majority of movies have been directed by men, and white men in particular. I think that's why parenthood often gets misplayed in movies about family and about kids, particularly mm-hmm. about infants. And again, I don't think you need to be a woman to make a movie like this. It just so happens that a woman made this movie that to me rings so true.
I would argue, I mean, I know it's a very different movie, but Three Men and a Baby, it's from the male perspective, but it does showcase the falling in love with a newborn, because it starts off with all those things that you know, like, oh, she's crying and it's awful and we don't want this. And then when you see the turn of them falling in love with her and taking her to the park and tossing her in the air, and they bring her to the pool and they dunk her underwater and they take a picture of her, like, you fall in love with being a parent. Like, I feel like that's a really nice parenthood arc, because, like, you see them, people who didn't even want kids, all become a father to this one little girl.
I'm sure that the Zac Efron Disney Plus remake that we're getting sometime in the next couple of years will be just as endearing.
No.
I think you're totally right, Corinne. And I think that it's instructive that both that movie and this movie were wild runaway hits. Mm-hmm. Like, what people really crave are people being good to each other, people taking care of other people, people doing the right thing. I mean, that movie, I have issues with that movie, because I think that plot is absurd.
I think it's great. It's a very female, it's a very feminist movie, in my opinion.
Well, it also is about, like, heroin dealers.
Yeah.
So, like, it's,
there is a whole drug dealing component.
Yeah, they give the baby away. It's great. It's gentle. It's miscommunication, guys.
There's something about that part. I get that it was a remake of a French movie, but there's something about that that makes me think they hedged a little bit in terms of, like, it just in terms of, like, going all in on the aspects that I want from this movie. Like, we also should have, like, some actual danger with heroin in this
movie. Drug dealers, yeah.
Three Men and Baby is actually great, and this movie is three steps above.
No, it's true. I mean, in terms of the message and everything, but
I do think it's worth, just for a quick second, talking about all the baby movies that were coming out around the time. You had Baby Boom for Keeps, Immediate Family, Three Men and a Baby, She's Having a Baby, and this film. Babies were all the rage in the 80s. So, for what that's worth, at this point in the film, Molly's forced to work with Albert again, even though she doesn't want to, by her boss, essentially.
Real fast, it's interesting that you brought up She's Having a Baby.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's kind of the one John Hughes movie that didn't nail its moment in time. Right? It's moment in the life cycle is really what I'm getting at.
It's a good movie.
I've actually never seen it.
It is a good movie. And I would pretty much argue that he's never really made a particularly bad movie. He didn't really write or produce a bad movie until, like, after Home Alone, until we got into like the weird 90s stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that She's Having a Baby is very cis and heteronormative. This is obviously a hetero couple in this, but it's very run of the mill in terms of the family that they're putting together. And I think that weirdly felt a little regressive in the moment and didn't connect in the way that this movie does. This is a little progressive and a little transgressive in a way that I don't think people necessarily felt, but I think people always kind of want.
So. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, I think She's Having a Baby, which I've only seen once, I think, but liked it. I also remember watching it thinking, like, I remember why, I get why this wasn't a hit. Like, it didn't go to the same places that John Hughes generally did. Like, it honestly just wasn't, like, that funny. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot more sort of heartfelt and kind of sad and, it's got a lot of good stuff in it, though. There's a great Kate Bush needle drop when she's having the baby, and he's not sure if she's going to make it. And there's some interesting stuff there. But basically, Molly's forced to work for Albert. She has another strange vision where his head explodes, which was amazing. Albert shows up at Molly's apartment to meet Mikey and gets in a fight with James, which is just sort of we just, I don't know. I don't know that we needed it, but whatever. It
is. I think it's a great scene. I think it's, I think that that is where James asserts himself as Mikey's guardian, if not his father.
Yeah.
Sure.
And, yeah, yeah, sure. And I think that's, you know, that's that, that line from Baby Boy. Anyone, any fool with a dick can be a daddy, but it takes a man to be a father. Albert's just a fool with a dick. And James is a father. And I think that that really does matter. I always felt bad for James in that fight, getting the phone to the head a few times.
Yeah.
But I do. I really. And then I love Mason's reaction upon coming home and seeing her destroyed apartment. It's not anger. It's just kind of like,
what happened here? I don't understand the logic of like, of how he came an hour before Molly would be home. I don't really understand.
That's where my bump is. It's more on, it's more logistical, but again, like that, these are little nitpicky things, but I'm just sort of like, wait, why are you here when Molly's not? And like, you have a key, so you didn't really need to knock.
Yeah.
Like, there's just all sorts of weird things that it's just kind of like, it is what it is. Again, I'm just saying. At this point, basically, the fight leads Molly to say like, James needs to take a hike. She decides she's going to try to give Albert a shot. Takes Mikey to Albert's office.
Things don't go well. It wasn't just the fight. Words were said after the fight that were really kind of mean. It was their first couple fight, and they had at each other a little bit. So it was almost like a breakup before they broke up. Before they were,
actually- I mean, it should be said that, and I didn't mean to breeze over it, but they almost have sex earlier in the film. James and Molly are basically about to do it, and
I was talking says no. about when they were dancing, and it ends in them, you know, 2 inches from each other's face, and Molly said, "You shouldn't do this in front of the kid."
Right. It's like the all. Well, what you're talking about, Phil, is the all is lost moment where you think they're just not going to get together, and then she goes back to Albert.
Correct. Correct.
That has one
she goes back to Albert. She thinks, I'm going to give this the best shot I can. She dresses Mikey up in a stupid outfit that he hates.
They're both pretty. As a kid, I never understood what the quote-unquote lamb was. She said the blue or the lamb. And I didn't really get that. I'm like, is that a color? Like, what are we dealing with here? But yeah, you put him in a lamb outfit.
Yeah,
you know.
My favorite part is when Mikey walks into Albert's office and he sees all his like figurines. He's like, "Ooh, that thing's cool. Ooh, look at those tiny things. Where could I stick them? Oh, I could stick them in there." And he's pointing to the light socket. Because as a kid, I definitely remember I took a key I found in my parents' bedroom and I was like, "Oh, where can I stick this?
Oh, God,
the socket." It was fine, but I thought it opened up a secret door.
That could have really killed you.
No, I was wrong.
That's interesting.
But it was just such a great little, like, we're going to stick it.
It's a great scene.
What if it did open up a secret door?
It could have. I had a dream that we had a secret part of our house.
That's not a bad idea for how to have a secret door.
For your future script. Yeah.
Just in life, if you want to have a secret door,
make it look like a socket.
No one's going to stick anything in there.
I used to have a lot of dreams and then think that I could act them out in real life. Like I had a dream about jumping off our banister with an umbrella and floating to the bottom. I tried to do that. My sister stopped me.
I have a lot of dreams about secret doors.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
No, it's fun. About,
yeah. All right. Go ahead.
Anyway.
So we're in this office scene, which actually I really enjoyed this scene because George Segal's a real piece of shit in this movie, but he's able to sort of do it in a way that that I feel like I hadn't really seen before. It was kind of a guy being like, "I know I'm a piece of shit and I'm sorry, but like I don't know how not to be." Like there was just something very sort of almost earnest and certainly honest about this character to a certain degree. Molly obviously recognizes that Albert is not interested in raising more kids. Mikey shits his pants and starts destroying the various things.
Wait, to go back to that George, the Albert thing.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because he does it twice. Like it's kind of like a new modern man. This is how the modern man's going to be shitty. Like the first reason he gives is that he's going through a selfish phase. And then when she gets mad, he's like, how could you be? It's like he's gaslighting her. And he's like, how could you be mad at me? I'm telling you honestly how I'm feeling. And this is how this is. I'm going to therapy and they're telling me this. And you don't believe me? And then the second reason is like, oh, I'm living alone for the first time. And I'm just, it's like in the name of honesty, in the name of my own personal self-growth, I'm saving you from the misery. That's such a weird thing that men do that you don't see a lot of, and the fact that she falls for it twice, she's just like, that's like, and that being the final straw, it's such a weird depiction of man.
It's very much the sort of, I'm a mess, you don't want a part of this, like this is it's a way out that feels selfless.
Mm-hmm. It's
but
very,
is also obviously
it's very nuanced. Like, it's not just like he's a bad guy. It's like this is his version of doing the right thing, and it's so fucked up because he's turning it against her.
Well, it's also
there's something. Like, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Very, it's a very therapy centric kind of idea, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like you just tell them how you feel, tell them your truth, and people can't get mad at you if you just tell someone the truth. And if the truth hurts, like. That is what that is, but it's interesting coming from there's something about this movie that I don't really want to talk about too much because it's not my favorite, but that is not very empathetic towards people who are going through issues. For instance, his wife's bulimia is played as a joke, right? His wife's bulimia is probably not a joke, right? His wife's bulimia is probably
it's probably
crisis.
Because of him.
Correct. Yes.
He's probably caused it.
And it's probably a crisis for this person and everyone around her. But like, you know, Kirstie Alley's like, well, she's bulimic. And Twin Kaplan is like, I mean, is that even a thing? I mean, you know, you sure she didn't have some bad Asian the night before? So it's just like, it's just on some like, we're not going to be empathetic for people who aren't in our lane. Now, I would also say like, I think today people get way too much leeway in terms of if I'm telling you the truth, it doesn't really matter if it affects your life. I've been dealing with myself. I'm working through my shit. I have to, you know, this is self-care for me. And if it means you don't have someone to, you know, take you to the airport, well, that's unfortunate because I just taking care of myself today means I have to sit in my bed. And I think that, you know, you're right, Corinne, as, you know, the next 32 years of American life kind of wear on, this idea becomes like people become more and more compassionate towards George Segal's point of view and less compassionate towards Kirstie Alley's point of view. And that may not be such a great thing.
Yeah. It's very manipulative.
Yeah. It's very manipulative.
I don't think he means it to be, but I think that that's an interesting kind of thing that we have, that we have inculcated to people in therapy, me being one of them, that your mental health, that your psyche is paramount, and worrying about other people is secondary.
Which actually, you know, leads nicely to the idea of Molly being there for Vincent. That's James's grandfather, who's sort of dealing with these issues at this old folks' home, which again shows that Molly cares about other people and that Albert is incapable of doing so. Anyway, basically Vincent's old folks home, he's being disruptive. It turns out that he's eaten this chocolate bar stash that James gave to the orderly who doesn't speak English. So he let him eat all the chocolate and he's acting out because of all the, you kind of got to want it. There's some gymnastics that are necessary in order to get to a place where it looks like the grandfather's going to get kicked out of the old folks home, but then Molly is able to talk to the director and explain the situation, and thus he doesn't get kicked out, and James and her make up basically, and James says, you know, they basically, you know, figure out a way to work through their issues, but they've left Mikey alone with the grandfather. The grandfather puts Mikey down. Mikey basically takes off because he sees a taxi cab outside the window and he thinks that it's James, so he chases after the taxi cab, which leads to a sequence that, quite frankly, Mikey should have been hit by a car 20 different times.
Legitimately terrifying.
It's like, it's really crazy.
But what's great is his logic that you listen to throughout that whole thing of like, okay, where I'm going to go? Well, I bet he, oh, look, there's a cab outside. That's got to be James because he drives a cab. I'm just going to go downstairs. Yeah. Well, oh, I'm going to push all these buttons on the elevator. One of them's going to take me there. Like, the, and I don't know. And I'm assuming what they did is they filmed the kid and then they put Bruce Willis in a booth and said, do whatever you want. But like the logic there is so kid, and it's just, it's like, oh, look, and there's a car that's running in. And he's like, oh, James taught me how to drive.
But I love that he takes, he rides the fruit cart.
Yeah.
He like jumps on the bottom.
He's like, let's go, guys.
Let's go, guys.
Well, that is also the magic trick of this movie, because if he wasn't giving you his internal monologue throughout that whole thing, you wouldn't believe any of it. You'd think this is like, this baby figured out to ride on a fruit cart, and but they've been priming you all film for this baby to be able to execute this kind of great escape at the end, in his babyish way that really, really, deeply, truly should not work, and works amazingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree, and again, like. It's a great climax. The kid's in danger. It's scary, but it's fun. I mean, like, again, it knows how to pay off at the end. And then his first words are "Dada," which he says to John Travolta, and you know, they kiss and everything is well. And then over the credits, she delivers their child together, Julie,
who will be Roseanne Barr,
who will be Roseanne Barr in a future sequel entitled "Look Who's Talking to."
But like nobody. So many of these movies, Phil, climax, credits,
Like, boom, we're out.
We're in and out. And you know what? I appreciate that. I don't need an epilogue.
No.
I would also say, too, most of the movies we've watched, I want to say, are all like 90 minutes, 100 minutes on the nugget. Like, these are movies that just like don't overstay their welcome. I mean, this is part of the problem with, and we've talked about this, I'm sure, on previous episodes, but like how bloated movies have become. This idea that people want more bang for their buck. They're spending $15, $17, sometimes $20 to see a movie. They want that movie to be two and a half hours long, so they feel like they're getting their money's worth. And ultimately, it hurts the films, blah, blah, blah. But this movie, to your point, Kenny, knows where it's going. Dada, kiss, credits, we're done. Like, you don't need anything more than that. You want to rate this, Kenny?
Of course I do. You want me to do it? You want me to go first? I'll do it.
You go first.
I would say in 1989 when I saw this movie, this definitely falls into the, you know, I was 7 years old and it was the best movie I ever saw category. So, and this is, it's not even worth rating in 89. It was a 99 in 89. Before this podcast, I'm not sure exactly why, but I was prepared to come in and give it the 92. Only because I've been like really throwing out like high 90s for these 89 movies, like over and over again. And is this as good as Baker Boys? Probably not. Is this as good for me as Major League? It's not. Is this as good as like, this is not quite at that, you know, rarefied air level as these other movies, but I gotta go higher. There's not an element of this movie that I don't completely love. I'm going to go 95. I think that's where this movie lives for me. And I do think when we do our, I guess it'll be our 52 weeks in review at the end of this Patreon, I expect Look Who's Talking to have some serious representation for my awards.
Your awards are going to be so stacked towards Look Who's Talking in Major League. It's going to be amazing.
The actual awards this year were so bad and lame.
So milk toast.
So many exciting movies for us that I can't wait to do it.
I can't wait to do it as well.
All right. So that's it.
So here's where I mean, I loved this film as a kid. It was a 90 probably for me in the, you know, 89-ish years. I mean, I watched it a lot. There were definitely scenes that I was just like, that really took me back. But by the end of the film, watching it yesterday, I was down to like an 81, 82. Like I just sort of, I don't know. I just wasn't feeling it as much. But now having talked about it and having reconsidered a lot of this, I'm back up. I think I'm at like an 88 88, 89, maybe a 90. I'm in that sort of range where I'm just like,
you there. I said yesterday, I thought we'd get you. Yeah.
And I was pretty convinced that you would, because listen, this movie, I got a soft spot for this movie, obviously. Like, I mean, it's obviously, it was a formative movie for me. I think it was more just like, it had been a really long time. I was watching it yesterday, just being like, what's going on? Like, what are we doing here? And I thought about, I think I just thought about it too much. Like, I think some movies just need to be felt and not thought about. And this is kind of one of those films where, like, don't overanalyze it. Don't overthink it. Like, just enjoy it for what it is. And it's a great movie. What about you, Corinne?
It was probably a perfect hundo back in the day. This and Three Men and a Baby, I think my sister and I watched once a week for probably a year. God. It was one of those things where we go to the video store and be like, well, who's talking or Three Men and a Baby? And we'd be like, let's get both. And then we just watch it. And watch it and watch it. So like a perfect 100. Going in yesterday, having rewatched it more recently, I remember thinking like, this was good when I rewatched it in January. But maybe I was just feeling silly. So I was like, maybe like, oh, probably a solid 85, you know, like this is going to be fine, but it's not going to be everything I hoped it would be. Honestly, movies that are just good, like just it's smart. There are real characters. There's character arcs. There are moments of loss and then redemption. Like it hits all of the marks of a solid movie. Totally. Like I always say that Thing You Do is one of my favorite movies of all time because it's just a good movie. It doesn't have to have, you know, darkness and mobsters and Aaron Brockovich running around. Like just good. Solid movie. And so for me,
I'm sorry. So is the perfect movie a dark movie with mobsters and Aaron Brockovich? Because it feels like that's what you're saying.
The Godfather meets Julia Roberts somewhere in there.
Okay.
Is what you think is good. So I say, like, I mean, there are other movies that probably, like That Thing You Do would be a 99. This is probably a good solid 94.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I do have like a kind of deep down secret rule that it's hard for me to just outside of Major League give 99s or really high 90 movies to movies that aren't kind of saying something.
Prestige.
But you find prestige everywhere, right? And I would say this movie, I think what we've really uncovered is, I think this movie is about a lot more. I mean, it's certainly about a lot more than Talking Baby, but it's a lot more than meets the eye. And I think, you know, to me, the takeaway personally is it is a really good representation of ideal fatherhood. And I think for a lot of other people, it's a normalization of different kinds of family, particularly single mothers with agency trying to figure out what's right for her family podcasting. Hours into a podcast. But yeah, I think that it's a really important movie in a lot of ways. Like there are going to be movies that are going to hit the public in a certain way, that are going to be seen by a lot of people, that are going to make a lot of money. It's really great when it's a movie like this that actually says something that's helpful in moving the culture and the conversation forward. And it's less good when it's a movie like Twilight, which is just about kissing. So, you know, I think that that's a really great thing that sometimes happens.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, you know, I knew you'd convince me of the depths of this movie or certainly of things that I hadn't thought about. I knew both of you would. And listen, I think that it's very easy to be dismissive of this movie. Mm-hmm. I get it. It's called Look Who's Talking. Mm-hmm. It's got a talking baby. It's got two people whose careers have taken different turns along the way, and I think that it's easy to be like, oh fuck that movie. It's a great movie and everyone should give it another shot.
And I think what's interesting about this, one final thought, what's interesting about this is that it doesn't have to be as good. It's kind of that thing of it doesn't have to be as good as it is. The shitty version of this movie is an overworked single mom who needs to find love again and explore her sexuality and try and have it all, and like that probably with a talking baby probably would have done maybe just as well because it's just people like the gimmick. But the fact that it has thoughtfulness and real characters and kind of these evergreen themes, that's what makes it a really good movie to me. And I think Kenny totally nailed that.
I think that all the time. I think like a lot of these movies, a lot of movies in general, don't have to be as good as they are. And what are the benefits of like working really hard on a pre-sold idea, right? Talking yep. Baby to some extent is a pre-sold idea.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I've mentioned it before, I'm running the James Bond series from the beginning. James Bond is a pre-sold idea. So I watched Goldfinger last night. Why even bother making Goldfinger good? Why even bother? Goldfinger is the third movie in a series where they're, you know, they're pre-sold and people are going to go no matter what. Well, I think having Goldfinger be as good as it was is the difference between having it be the third and final movie and the and have it be the kind of thing that can go on for years and years and years and years. And I think like having, you know, Look Who's Talking be good is the difference between having Talking Baby movie, you know, be the end of your career for someone like it was for whoever, you know, Bob, what's his name, who made Baby Geniuses, which it was. Kind of the end of his career, and having the capital to go and make Clueless, which is a crazy fucking swing in its own right.
Yep. 100%.
So it's always worth making the movie be really fucking good every time. Mm-hmm. And I applaud everybody, executives and producers and everybody who give their all to everything they do, no matter how dumb or commercial or boring it might seem. Like, we have watched so many movies, particularly in the last 20 years. I'm saying the opposite, Phil. So many movies that would be trash in the wrong hands. Like,
no, for sure,
everything
for sure.
Tony Scott ever did. That is Scott. That are really great because he fucking gives a shit.
Yeah.
So, or gave a shit.
No, I mean, I'm on a real Tony Scott kick right now. I've almost seen all of them. Unstoppable. Yeah.
That's the one I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. Unstoppable is a shitty train movie in most hands.
Yeah.
And Phil, we just did Universal Soldier on mm-hmm. on the regular feed.
On the regular
feed. Apparently, according to, you know, Tom, our guest, Universal Soldier 3 and 4 are masterpieces. And the guy who did Universal Soldier 3 and 4 went on.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, we watched the second one.
Yes, which is a disaster. But he just did a movie called The Loan, which has gotten like incredibly good reviews. And this guy might, you know, wind up becoming like a real player. So if you have the opportunity to make something, even if it's as stupid as Universal Soldier 3, have it be really fucking good. And you might be able to make an indie movie eventually that becomes something that people really like.
Yep.
That's it. That's my.
It's the whole like just don't phone it in, guys. If you're lucky enough to get past the velvet rope and someone's letting you make a thing, like fucking make it good, you know.
Yeah.
Life's too short. Corinne, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me
on and talking about Talking Babies with us.
Love that. Podcast like it, just podcast like it,
podcast like it's 1989. Baby fish mouth. Ethel baby Mammy. Fish mouth.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.